Okay, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's great to see everyone. This is great. I get to sit this time, which is really good. Maybe I should do that every week. Anyway, really a big welcome. Great to see you to this event, which you've called Being Emotionally Strong. So I just want to first of all begin by welcoming our esteemed guest, Rabbi Levi Shmutkin.
Everyone, good morning.
Actually, when I got his bio, originally he's known as Rabbi Levi, but I knew that's going to be very confusing around here, so I didn't do that. So before we get into it, and I want to get into it soon, I just want to give a little introduction, a little bit of context. So we've often spoken about this, that over the last number of decades there's been a really strong awareness, mental health, emotional health, and so on. And yet so many people are still very unhappy. Depression is on the rise. Lots of anxiety is on the rise, loneliness, and so on and so forth. And we all struggle with the question, of course, how can we be emotionally strong and how can we strengthen our emotional well-being? So you've often heard me at the Thursday morning shiur quote my mentor, the famous Lubavitcher Rebbe of blessed memory, who wrote extensively and spoke very often about growth, about emotional being. But Rabbi Shmutkin did something very, very special, which he'll tell us about soon, hopefully. And he spent a number of years researching, exploring the Rebbe's writings, the Rebbe's stories of the Rebbe, videos that the Rebbe spoke to people on, and put them together in the most amazing way. And the result was this book, Letters for Life. Now, some of you are familiar with Letters for Life because we did two series on it recently. And then when I got the call that Rabbi Shmutkin is coming to Australia and is going to be talking about his book, I thought, wow, it's amazing. We just did two series on it, and it would be so wonderful to actually talk to the author himself. It was published just a year ago?
Some year ago, yeah.
Yeah, about a year ago, 2024. And it became really, really popular. We are going to, after today, have books to sell, and Rabbi Levi Shmutkin will sign them and so on. But just to end off the introduction, everything is by divine providence. Of course, nothing happens by chance, as we know. And being that this research and this these insights come from the writings of the Rebbe, important to note, of course, that we're just 2.5 weeks out from the Rebbe's Yahrzeit, the Rebbe's day of passing, which is the 3rd of Tammuz. So it makes it even more significant that we're doing this session today. So that's enough of an introduction. I want to jump right into it. So Rabbi Levi, a soft launch. Tell us a little bit about who you are, first of all, and what led you mainly to this research and ultimately the book. Go for it.
Okay. First of all, good morning, everyone. It's amazing to be here. It's my first time in Australia, so nice to have such a beautiful crowd and such a extraordinary conversation. How did I get to the book? So I actually never thought I would write a book or be an author. It wasn't on my radar ever. I was growing up, becoming a person of my own, like we all do. And despite having had a good education, good parents, good friends, as my own mind and heart started emerging, I started feeling something inside that was pulling at me that I didn't understand why or what it wants, but I knew it needed attention and it needed direction and tools that were beyond what I had in my cachet at the time. So that's when I found myself gravitating to this extensive body of literature of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's letters, which to date, we have accessed over 20,000 letters written to people of all walks of life, going through the ups and downs that we all experience, insecurities, the fears, the anxieties, the loneliness, isolation. And I found myself there in yeshiva, reading one letter, another letter, another letter, and instead of the words just being addressed to someone else, they started coming off the page, coming alive to me, and they were mirroring the experiences that I was having. And I'm watching the Rebbe take 3,000 years of Jewish wisdom and bring it down to the thoughts and feelings that we all have and that I was having. So I started taking down notes of the themes the Rebbe was counseling people. I say, here's one idea that I see the Rebbe continuously suggesting, and here's another idea, and here's another idea. And as you read more of these letters, I started detecting patterns. And when I felt I had something of a comprehensive picture of some of the Rebbe's core principles, I started to try to implement them in my own life. And some of them are cognitive, some of them are emotional, some of them are behavioral. A lot of the Rebbe's guidance is very practical. You know, it has to be very actionable. But over the course of a few months, I, every day, day in, day out, I tried to exercise these cognitive or behavioral tools from the Rebbe. And I saw an extraordinary change in the way I felt, in the way my inner world was operating, my thoughts, my feelings. And I think this is an experience we all have, is that when we go through a darker time, when we break out of it by the help of a friend, by the help of a mentor, by the help of some higher wisdom, we have a strong sense of gratitude, for the wisdom we've been allowed through someone else, or through the Torah, or through a Rebbe, a Tzaddik. And sometime in those few months is when I thought I should try to take these patterns, these ideas, these tools that I found so impactful for myself, and to try to share them with the English reading community, because I didn't see them properly distilled in English. I did not realize what that would entail. You know, I thought 3-4 months and then kind of move on. There I was 3-4 years later, still trying to haggle it together. But thank God after 5 years, we pushed it out and here we are. So that's a brief background.
Beautiful. As Rosh Patki mentioned, what are how many thousand letters did you say we have today?
20,000.
We have 20,000 letters, 31 volumes or something?
33, yeah.
33 volumes, so it's a lot of work, a lot of research, and extremely well done. You can see that my book is very worn out because I've used it a lot. Just one more general question, then we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty. I know that the Rebbe, even in physical illness, was a great supporter of preventative medicine, right? From the reading of your book, I saw that what you did was you divided it into two sections. The first is the essentials for healthy life, and the second is overcoming darkness. Would you say the first is like a preventative one, I think? Or maybe you can talk to that a little bit and how that reflects in the book and those two sections that you made the book into.
Yeah, so absolutely. You're touching on, I think, a critical point in the Rebbe's counseling. And that is, I was watching once a talk where the Rebbe was saying about the theme of preventative medicine. He says, when you do preventative medicine, you don't get a Nobel Prize because nobody sees the effect. The people, everyone's healthy. When you respond to an illness and you cure cancer, then you get a Nobel Prize. But there isn't much credit in preventative medicine because you don't see the effect. Everybody's walking around well. But if you care about people and you care about diminishing suffering and helping people's lives, there's nothing better and there's nothing more important than actually investing resources in building preventative care that makes sure in the first place we don't end up in those darker spots which need more severe cures. And when I started out writing the book and thinking about how to structure it, it was clear to me that even though I think people, when they buy books, they're usually buying to solve a certain problem, a certain sense of pain. So the chapters in the second half of the book, bad moods, self-criticism, worry, I think are more maybe compelling. But I thought to be true to the Rebbe's approach to emotional health, the book should and must begin with the essentials for healthy life, the principles that keep us strong in the first place and make sure we have the resilience and strength to not fall so easily. And that's exactly why I did begin the book with that. So that's correct. Thank you.
So talking about themes, you said that when you started researching the Rebbe's letters, there were certain patterns, certain themes that emerged from his correspondence, from his interaction with other people, from his writings. Reading your book and reading some of the Rebbe's letters, I have to also mention that in the book, there's what Rabbi Shpatin calls the endnotes, and they're much more academic and much more involved, but they're fantastic. So thank you. It's a good opportunity to be able to, you know, talk about gratitude. No, it's really amazing, and there's so many references. You can look them up if you have the resources and so on. But one of the patterns for me that seemed to come out very strongly, and I'm sure there's other themes as well, is the concept of the Rebbe seems to encourage people to move away from self. Like not to be so over obsessed with your struggles. And I mean, obviously you have to deal with your struggles, but not to be involved with self and to move to something higher than self. So first of all, Do you feel that's an accurate assessment of what I sort of discovered in the book? And also, maybe you can talk about some of the other themes as well. Take your time. It's a big question.
I think it is accurate on a basic level, but I think it's very important to clarify something. I'm actually going to read a little bit of a letter here that I think talks to this point and is important to understand. It is actually in the introduction to the second half of the book. So it's a letter to a young woman who wrote to the Rebbe asking about the role of the intellect and emotion in a person's life. What are you supposed to approach with the mind? Where's the heart's role? You know, emotions work. They don't work mathematically. They don't work rationally. There's up and down that you love and you're upset and you're, and then there's the mind. There's the rational part of ourselves. And what's the balance and what's the role that each play? And she wrote in her letter that it seems to her that we shouldn't be just suppressing our emotions with our rational mind only. That doesn't make sense. But she wanted confirmation from the Rebbe what the Rebbe thought. So the Rebbe writes as follows, and I'm going to come back to your question, Retzikus. Regarding your question, it's from 1959. Regarding your question about the role of your intellect and emotions, you are correct in thinking that you should not suppress your emotions. Rather, as with all areas of a person, your emotions should be activated so you can reach your fullest potential. Right? In the Rebbe's worldview, if Hashem designs us in a certain way and he gives us a central part of ourselves that's emotional, there's a role to it. And part of us becoming the most actualized and fullest version of ourselves must include having live and active and moving emotions that are not pushed under a rug, but are actually liberated and alive and activated in the Rebbe's words. However, so that's what the Rebbe says. First of all, you are certainly correct. Shouldn't that part of yourself should be alive and moving and activated. However, the activity of your emotions should be under the guidance of your intellect. Put differently, in the words of our sages, this is a phrase from Tanya, which Tanya takes from the Zohar, the mind should rule the heart. But here the Rebbe hones in on those words, the mind should rule the heart, or in Hebrew it's Moach Shalat Alev, and he says, this teaching indicates two points. One, the mind should rule, right? The mind should be in the driver's seat. But two, it doesn't say the mind should rule, right? It doesn't say the mind should rule, period. It says the mind should rule the heart. So two, the heart must be active. There has to be a heart. There has to be a heart that's alive and moving and it's there for a purpose and it's there to be part of our life. However, it should be under the guidance of the mind. And actually, after the book came out, there was an individual, actually a very influential person, who reached out to me and he said, everything in the book, this phrase of how the Rebbe interprets the mind should rule the heart jumped out at him, because in his days in yeshiva, he heard this phrase again and again. And to him, it was always sounded like, or was taught to him as the mind should rule, period. And there isn't a role for feelings in a person's life. And that was very difficult for him. He actually left Yiddishkeit in it for many years. And he said this letter was transformative to him to see how the Rebbe takes the same exact phrase. And he says, no, look at the words. The mind should rule the heart. You need to have a heart. You need to have emotions. Those emotions need to be alive and activated, but they should be under the guidance of the mind. Why am I saying all this? To circle back to your question, Rory, is because I think this nuance is very important in this conversation in the Rebbe's counseling about the self and beyond the self, is that as a general direction of where healing and health is found, it's certainly where the Rebbe is directing people and elevating people is to become connected to a bigger whole, to become connected to our role in this world, to become connected to our higher soul, to become connected to other people, to be a giver, to be connected to Hashem and Hashem's presence in our life. However, I think it's critical to understand in that conversation is that that's a work that happens with and through our emotional life and not with a hammer, because that is not only won't work, it's actually neglecting the beautiful world that Hashem gave to us of emotions, like the Rebbe says, of course it has to be activated so we can reach our fullest potential. But the way to health and healing of our emotions is by working with them to liberate them from becoming entangled in their own little world and to connect them to something bigger and something higher than only ourselves. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no. It's just to add, it's interesting because currently on a Thursday morning, we're doing a course based on the work of Viktor Frankl, which I know the Rebbe in Viktor Frankl's day, in terms of the world of psychology, he was very supportive of Viktor Frankl. And we've told the story many times of how the Rebbe sent a message to him not to give up and to spread his logotherapy and so on. And so many of that theme, I mean, he talks about moving outward, in other words, having a purpose in life. So yes, of course, God gave us each a unique contribution and we need to be in touch with that. But it only, something really works when you're able to untangle yourself from yourself and connect to something higher, which is what you were just describing. So on that, maybe we go to this next question. There's a fascinating chapter in the book, which I think I read most of the endnotes on that chapter. You've titled the chapter Pivoting, and it's got to do with a concept that is brought not only in the Rebbe's writings, but all the way back in the book of Tanya, from the first Chabad Rebbe, which is the concept of Hesach Hadas. Hesach Hadas means, or one way to translate is distracting your mind away from something. And we find this concept both in Tanya and both in the Rebbe's writings a lot, in different contexts, in different ways, of how to deal with toxic emotions or toxic thoughts. So, for example, in the book of Tanya, it talks about if you have a thought of jealousy or a thought of being violent to someone else or hate, to push it away and to distract yourself away, not to deal with it so much, but rather to completely pivot away from it and replace it with something positive. In fact, there's one letter that that I discovered in the end notes of the book where the Rebbe actually tells someone, you need to distract yourself even from yourself, not only from your emotions, but from yourself. Like you're too busy with yourself. Like for the next year or something, I think the Rebbe says, or 2 years or something, take a period in your life and just stop thinking about yourself so much. Now, obviously, it didn't mean you should never think about yourself. We know that in Judaism, cheshbon ha-nefesh, reflecting and taking stock and, you know, analyzing self-reflection is an important thing as long as it doesn't become overdone. But nevertheless, the Rebbe felt this person was like doing it too much. And really, the outcome was they were just busy with himself all the time. And therefore, the Rebbe says, even not only distract yourself from your thoughts, but even from yourself. And I raise that because it was a very important chapter, I think, because, and maybe it's not the way you understand it, but I understood it in the way where the Rebbe is a little bit at odds with a lot of common thinking. Today, there's the surge of emotional regulation. Of course, we need to be in touch with our emotions. And as Rabbi Shplotkin said before, emotions are very important and it's a critical part of the human experience. But there's an over-obsession with sitting with your emotions, even toxic emotions. What triggered them? Why did they come? And there's a lot of involvement with emotional reflection in order to bring what they call emotional regulation. It seems to me that the Rebbe is not such a follower of that, more supportive of replace it with something positive, get it done. Of course, you need to be in touch. You know, we've talked about this many times, that the Rebbe talks about the importance of grief, for example, how it's so important to express your emotion in a positive way and in a channeled way and so on. But I want you to talk to that a little bit, and we have time, so take your time on this. But that chapter, what does it mean, and when is that important? When is it important, yes, to acknowledge the emotion? When is it important maybe to sit with it, or is it ever important to sit with it? And what is that philosophy of Hesach Hadas? What is that philosophy of moving away from your emotions and replacing it with positive things?
Well,
I hope you remember the chapter, because it's a... No, I'm kidding.
It's actually the chapter I rewrote the most times in the book. It's the hardest chapter.
I think it's hard. That's when I heard you were coming. I said, that's the chapter I'm going to definitely bring up.
So I'd say a few things that I think are important to understand in the Rebbe's philosophy of Hesach Hadas. Maybe should we, what's, how would you translate the word Hesach Hadas in the Australian way? I don't know.
It's a hard phrase to translate, but let's just use the word Hesach Hadas. It's distracting yourself from
diverting.
Yeah. As you call it, pivoting, whatever.
So actually, yesterday I was in Perth last night, and someone asked me in the audience if there's something that I now, if I would write the book, that I would either emphasize more, or that I feel that I didn't properly articulate, or something that I discovered since the book came out. And I thought about it, and one of the ideas is connected very much to the Hesach Hadas chapter. And that is, it has become more into sharper focus for me, certain elements of the Rebbe's philosophy of Hesach Hadas. And I think I would have articulated it in stronger words. And that is, it's actually a letter that I saw, or only really understood, even though I actually have it in the end notes, but I only thought about it after the book came out, where the Rebbe quotes a verse from Kohelet, King Solomon, where he says that he searched around the world, he was looking for universal truths and for wisdom, and he hasn't found anything. The only thing that he found was Ayach Hazem Motasi, Elikim Asis Adam Yashar, Vehema Bikshu Cheshbonos Rabim, that Hashem, God, made man straightforward or pure or upright or upstanding, and they have searched out many schemes. The simple interpretation is that it's another pessimistic outlook on the world, that Hashem made us good and we managed to mess it up also. Something to that effect. You know. But in this letter, the Rebbe takes this pasuk, takes this verse, and he brings it down to the psychological world that we all have. And he uses it as a principle when he's explaining Hesach Hadas to a young woman who wrote to him about her fluctuations and about her entanglements. And the Rebbe says the sisma klolus, the general approach here is, the underlying understanding, is that Hashem made us straightforward. And psychologically, the way the Rebbe is interpreting that means we all have a natural health. We all have a natural wellspring of straightforwardness, of connectivity that goes, that moves, that's healthy. And sometimes we get entangled into various negativity, worry, fear, unhappiness, regret, guilt. It happens. But what the Rebbe finishes telling you is that because it comes from us, meaning it's not, we're not inherently messed up, we're not inherently entangled. We begin alikimas adam yasher. We have a straightforward inner health. We have an inner straightforwardness, and the entanglements come from us who ended up becoming entangled. Therefore, the takeaway is that we can also cut the lifeline of that entanglement and move ourselves elsewhere. And the metaphor that came to me only after the book came out is, and when I was thinking about this letter, is, you know, our mind is like, it's like a garden. And yes, weeds will show up. It's part of life. But we carry the water. We carry the water in our hands, whether we realize it or not. And that's a big part that sometimes we don't realize, because we think we're reacting to our mind. Our mind takes us wherever it wants, and we're not in control at all. But what the Rebbe tries to keep reminding people, including in this letter, is that we carry the water, whether we realize it or not, and we are able to feed and allow to grow whichever plants we choose. And if we water the weeds, they will grow. But if we take away the water and we move it to the beautiful flowers and trees, that'll be the part that will grow, and the weeds will slowly fade out of the garden. And understanding that is very important, that we are coming off a healthy soil, and that's in the background, And the lifeline of what grows and what doesn't is in our hands. And if we choose to pivot and we put in the effort, and it's very difficult because when the weeds are in the forefront of our imagination or in the forefront of our mental space, it's hard to move away because they're very consuming. But that's where I think the teeth of what the Rebbe says is, and maybe different than what we're going to, with the other point you brought up, that it's different maybe what you're going to find in other places. And this is what I found myself in my own experience, is that it does take a leap of faith when you're actually pivoting away from a negativity that's consuming you. Because when you make that pivot, at least in my experience, it feels like you're doing something wrong because you're not actually giving attention to the part of yourself that's calling for so much attention right now. And how could you just involve yourself in something entirely unrelated? It feels like if you're fighting with it or you're thinking about it, you're obsessing over it, at least you're doing something, you feel like you're doing something about it. You're involving yourself in it. But to get involved in a totally different part of the garden, I mean, that would feel like wrong. But to realize that when you're moving to a different part of the garden and watering it, you are doing the best thing you can for the weeds and to get rid of them. That takes a leap of faith. And it's not easy in the beginning. And you have to just trust the process. That's what I found. And actually, I'm actually someone who naturally would not be drawn to this type of approach. It's only because I learned it from the Rebbe that I made that leap many times and that I keep seeing how it works. When you do it for a week or 2 weeks, a month, 2 months, the weeds just, they fall out. They fall out of the system because we have this inner straightforwardness. So I think just some of that understanding, I would have hoped, I maybe the next edition, but that's something that I think gives a little bit more, that letter about, based on the verse in Kohelet, that we have inner straightforwardness and we are the ones that both create the entanglement, but therefore are empowered to end the entanglement by pivoting somewhere else. It's very helpful in understanding the whole idea. That said, I do want to add that Hesach Hadas is non-binary. And what I mean by that is, and that's part of why it took me so long, because I wanted to make sure that this idea comes through in the chapter, is that pivoting can happen alongside and should happen alongside taking very active steps that are directly connected to the struggle that you have. And I'll actually read to you one letter that to me brings us into sharp focus that I included in the book. It's a letter, it's actually a handwritten note to a couple who wrote to the Rebbe that they're experiencing stagnation in their relationship, and it seems to the point that they were considering maybe separating. So the Rebbe wrote to them a handwritten note, three paragraphs, and I find each one of these paragraphs so much to unpack, and I'll share with you connected to this point. The Rebbe writes like this. In the Torah of Truth, our sages have extolled the greatness of marriage and the value of maintaining one. And I want to pause on this for a second, because even though it's not directly connected to this question, but I think one of the things that makes the Rebbe's counseling distinct is the fact that there is values that we aspire to and that anchor the conversation. It's not everything is equal. We're beginning this conversation with an aspiration that marriage is something that we try to maintain. And that shapes the conversation, the first thing the Rebbe says. And I think that itself deserves just to sit on for a second. With that point is made, the Rebbe continues. He says like this. In matters connected with the subconscious, it sometimes happens that without intention and without identifiable action, something changes and an internal emotional blockage breaks open naturally. And the word naturally is underlined. I'll read it again. Matters connected to the subconscious, it sometimes happens that without intention, without identifiable action, something changes and an internal blockage breaks open naturally. And I think what this is saying is that there are different parts of ourselves and that work on different frequencies. So there's a part of our life that works mathematically, right? If you have a financial problem, you need to take certain steps and that'll have certain statistical results. And that's the process that needs to take. And it's very identifiable. But there's deeper parts of ourselves that don't work in a mathematical equations. you can't say, oh, I'm going to push the door and this will open. It works in a different way. It's subconscious, attraction, connection, passion. And in that world, actually, the weight and the pressure that you're putting onto it by saying, what can I do right now that will open it or that will close it, or that actually chokes the ability for something to open, for that blockage to open naturally and to open in a way that is not forced. That's the second thing the Rebbe says. And in areas of the subconscious, it moves in a different way. So it's important to understand that. Then the Rebbe says this. Therefore, you should continue putting an effort in the direction where you've seen benefit and success in the past, at least for a period. Seeing a psychologist, I should go to counseling. Visiting the Holy Land during your vacations, to take vacation together when you have time. I guess they appreciated Israel. What Israel? And importantly, to minimize worrying about this and to divert your attention in the Hebrew, to have Hesach Hadash from all this to the extent possible. I mean, Hashem grant you success and you should be able to share good news. And what I always struck me about this answer is that I think if you're thinking simplistically, it's pushing in two very different directions. Hey, seeing a psychologist together and taking vacations together is a very active response to the stagnation, and it's directly addressing it. And then the Rebbe says to Hesach Hadash and to not worry about it, not to think about it. But I think this is an illustrative of what you see in many answers. The Hesach Hadash works alongside taking action. And what that means is that in the Rebbe's conception, the preoccupation and the obsession and the becoming consumed with an issue is part of what gives it life and makes it more difficult for the steps you take to actually have effect. And therefore, alongside seeing a psychologist and alongside taking vacation, try to lift the weight and the pressure that you're putting on this relationship every single second and worrying about it and assessing it and seeing where it's holding, and let the steps have their impact without your consuming it. Water other parts of your garden while you take the steps that you need to respond to the problem. Still use Hesach Hadash, and that Hesach Hadash will actually be the best thing you can do to make the steps that you are taking to have effect. So I'm not sure, I hope the point is coming through, but the idea what I'm trying to say is that Hesach Hadash doesn't just mean divert your attention and don't do anything. Divert your attention and do something. Divert your attention and take the steps you need to take. But while you're taking those steps, don't put your whole emotional weight on it, because that'll make a crack. Try to divert your attention while you're taking the steps. Take the steps when you need to and think about other things and involve yourself in other things when you don't need to be thinking about the problem, and that'll help the problem be solved. So that's just another point. There's many more points in Hesach Hadash. I can talk about it for many hours, but I'll leave it with that.
Maybe just to add one more component to it, because it seems to come through also, and I'd love you to comment on this, that there's also different levels of Hesach Hadash, because the Rebbe seems to, in the letters that deal with this, seems to talk about different causes, different types of toxic thoughts or emotions that come into a person. Like for example, he says, there can be sometimes where we have a worry or we have emotions that have a legitimacy, they have a basis. Mm-hmm. And maybe, that's right, you have Hesach Hadash, but you also need to deal with the issue. But then he refers to something, I've forgotten exactly the terminology, he refers to some thoughts that have no basis, like sometimes a person, you know, will give a lecture or something and then comes along and is obsessed with maybe he messed up or maybe he did something stupid, and it's just baseless, it's got to do with his own insecurity. And there it seems to be that just stop worrying about it. Just go and do something useful kind of thing. And just dismiss it because it doesn't have a basis anyway. Is that what you say that's good?
Absolutely, yeah. I see you actually read the chapter. It's amazing. No, it's in there.
He's finding his letters. You can see my highlights and my notes. And yeah. that was an important distinction. Those distinctions.
So absolutely. I think there are thoughts. The reason why I wanted to say that is to exactly discern what is itself difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are times where the Rebbe writes to people emphatically that because there is no outside rootedness to this problem, meaning it's not that you're worrying about a financial problem that exists beyond yourself or a relationship problem that actually exists in the real world and you're becoming overconsumed by it, there is actually no problem here. It is all in your head. And in those cases, the Rebbe goes much more emphatically, almost full power on Hasach Hadas. Says, listen to me, get involved in other stuff, volunteer, do work, learn, study, pivot your mind, and just trust me, in a few weeks, a few months, you'll look back and you say, what was I even thinking about in the first place? So there certainly is that space where things that don't have any rootedness in anything, and it's all in our head. And that doesn't mean it's less painful, but that just means at the end of the day, it's all in our head. We sometimes don't realize that. When we're in it, we think it's bigger than just in our head. And you need someone else to tell you, honey, it's actually all in your head. So, yeah. So that's certainly a distinction in the Rebbe's counseling, absolutely.
And also, I think, thinking about it and sort of trying to experience it, diverting, even when you need to divert your attention, that's actually a difficult thing, as you said before, because it's a leap of faith and it's quite hard. And something that I thought of when I was reading it is, and learning it in general, is that the mind, we have a concept in Kabbalah that the thought of a person always is active, right? We never stop thinking. Therefore, if you want to divert yourself away from something, you do need to have something to replace it with. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like you give various examples. It is volunteering or having, exploring positive things and learning positive things, so you have what to actually replace negativity with. Otherwise, it's going to be much more difficult. You say that's correct?
Absolutely. Sometimes there even says to have things prepared. Sometimes there ever says to consult with friends about what would be the best thing that would occupy you. I actually saw an interesting private audience the Rebbe had where he said, Torah has a unique quality in this, that it is, the Torah is called the Torah of light, and light has a nature, a definition, to melt darkness. So there's a unique power to Torah thoughts or Torah study in dismissing and rather than dismissing, than melting negative thoughts. However, the Rebbe told this young man, if you feel that there's no area in Torah that occupies you to the same level that the news or a book or something neutral captures your mind, the priority in Hasach Hadas is to move to somewhere that will take your mind away. So if it needs to be something that is not Torah and that's the thing that occupies you most and you think will be most effective, go with that. Because it should be something that just takes your mind off. If you love, reading about gardening, or you love reading about history, delve into that.
Beautiful. And that analogy of the gardening is a beautiful analogy. Love it. One of the chapters you have in the book there is about worry. And I think it's an important chapter because I've never ever met someone Jewish that doesn't worry. And of course, what the Rebbe does, as he does multiple times in his writing, is address the concept of bitachon, which is surrendering to God, trusting Him, letting Him run the show, and believing that it's going to be okay and He has our back. I think that's a quick definition of bitachon, but it's not a simple thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to do. So maybe you can just talk a little bit about, briefly, because we are going to run out of time soon, about some of the strategies that are necessary to actually reach that perspective that I'm giving this over, I'm letting God run the show, and I'm going to stop worrying so much.
You're asking how can we attain?
Some of the strategies, like what do you do to actually, what's the strategy to actually come to that perspective? Because it's not our default natural. Mm-hmm. I think I would say at different levels, but our default position is to start worrying.
In the letters, the Rebbe takes a pretty traditional approach with that, and he recommends studying. He recommends studying about bitachon. The two primary things that I've seen is, one is the Shar Bitachon from the Chovat HaLevavot, from
it's about 14, I think 13th century. So that's Ibn Bar Bakula,
And the second thing the Rebbe often recommends is studying, and it's actually much shorter, so if you have less time, is the chapter 23 in Psalms, in Tehillim, Parak Chav Gimel. And sometimes Rebbe says, learn it in English, learn it in your own pace, know the content of it, you don't need to know the exact words, and just repeat it to yourself. Learn it again, remind yourself of it, think about it, And I think what's important in this conversation is to understand that building bitachon and trust in Hashem and these methods of learning Shaar Bitachon or learning chapter 23 shouldn't be like a first aid emergency response when you're worrying only, then you try to bring it in, then, oh, it's not working. It's something you have to work on when it's a good day also, as an exercise, as a perspective in life, as a context for the way from which we emerge when we have to face the human experience. And in that way, it builds in a more stable and balanced way and becomes a very part of who we are. When you see the Rebbe, it's not like, oh, when you feel worried that second, just stuff and bitachon. I'm not sure it'll necessarily work in the same way as when you make it a consistent exercise, either on a daily or weekly basis, to learn about it and to meditate on it and to think into it and to reflect on it. And then it becomes part of our natural thinking. And as a result, we worry less.
Yeah. Something that struck me, I mean, talking about internalizing it and meditating on it, something that struck me often when the Rebbe talks about learning things that strengthen bitachon, and he quotes that philosophical work of Rabbeinu Bachya, he often says to learn it two or three times. Like, once obviously isn't going to be enough.
Yeah.
That's the idea. You can't just learn it. It's not a thing you learn and then you fix it. It's a lifelong thing where you've got to learn it and internalize the concepts, because it involves a certain surrender and giving up control,
yeah,
which is very difficult. I do want to get some questions from the audience, but just one more point before we do that. So I'll give you a few minutes to think of questions if you haven't got one already. So the Rebbe talks about many challenges, and you have many chapters in the book dealing with so many different types of challenges. We know that challenges come in different forms. So a person can worry, a person can be sad, a person can be lonely, and it's just part of, as you described, your own background, part of the normal ups and downs of the human experience. But there are sometimes, of course, where it descends into something much deeper than that and becomes something more clinical or pathological, where people really experience like severe depression or severe anxiety in the form of OCD or real issues that become what I would term as a mental health problem, but a mental health illness. In other words, like I always like to say, it's not depression with a small D, it becomes with a big D, right? Where intervention is sometimes needed. And I wonder if you could just talk that a little bit, because we do find, not that often, I think the Rebbe often seems to be discussing the day-to-day struggles of life, but we do find that sometimes, like you said, even now with marriage, about recommending even psychology, therapy, or even psychiatry. So do you want to just address that a little bit?
I think you said it all, no?
Yeah. Well, how do you feel the Rebbe's view on that is? Like, what is the Rebbe's view on and when you do have to have outside intervention, are these concepts still helpful? Can they work together? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So, first of all, absolutely, you see the Rebbe recommending both psychologists and psychiatrists. One interesting thing when it comes to recommending psychologists or in that world is, in contrast to physical health, where the Rebbe makes clear the priority is they should be professional, their level of professionalism and their level of care for you, their friendship to you. When it comes to emotional health and psychology, the Rebbe emphasizes the importance of checking the values of the psychologist to make sure that they have respect and for faith. And actually, one interesting letter that I found striking, where the Rebbe says about also having the value of respecting parents, that they see that as a value in life, to have kibud av va'em, to have respect of parents in general, is something that is we aspire to. And that is very important when going and opening your heart and your mind to someone else, to know and to make sure that it's someone that aligns and respects and has space for the values we have as Jewish people, and our connection to Hashem and our connection to the mitzvahs. So that's just one thing to say on that note, alongside, of course, the Rebbe's continuous advising people to go when they need help. And about the question of if the ideas in the book or the ideas in the Rebbe's counseling apply even in more extreme cases, I think absolutely. And I think that's one of the very special things in the Rebbe's counseling is a beautiful letter that I included in at the end of every chapter is photocopies of the book. Photocopies of the Rebbe's English letters. And there's one long letter to a director a hospital in New York of the special needs children department. And he wrote to the Rebbe asking him for advice about how the Jewish community can do better with their special needs children. And one of the things the Rebbe writes him at great length is that people have a misconception or have a mistake, and they think, look, these children don't have the easiest lives necessarily, and it's difficult. Why should we shouldn't complicate their lives more with bringing in Jewish practice like Hanukkah, Tefillin. It's difficult enough. Let them play in the sand and let them play with the toys and let them be. Rebbe says, you don't understand. I'm paraphrasing. But they're much smarter than you think they are. They realize that you're discriminating against them. And their brother is doing Yiddishkeit. And their sister is doing a Seder. And they're just left to be because, and they sense that on the negative side. And on the positive side, when you give them the ability that despite the challenges that they have, which obviously need professional help, and this is a letter to professionals, to allow them the connection and the stability and the anchor that being connected in a real way to Jewish identity and their family, their rights, and their family and their history and their tradition, has emotional health value, even in such mental spaces of being autistic in extreme ways and so on and so forth, people that are not necessarily responsive in ordinary way. They're very emphatic that they understand more and connect more with the mental health value of actual mitzvot. And the same goes for bitachon, and the same goes for the other tools that the Rebbe counsels, that he, I think part of his worldview was that these will carry on and translate also, no matter what the extremes of the human experience take us, but we'll need more professional help, we'll need more insight, we'll need more, medical advice. But the idea that Hashem is with us to help us, and the idea that, doing a mitzvah can make us stronger, will translate and continue always. So yes, I think that's important to say.
Thank you. We have time for a couple of questions. Yes, Judy, please.
This is probably a subset of worry. How do you go about influencing people, for example, as a parent, or people who have the wrong information, whether politically or whatever? You're worried about that, and you want to influence them in some way that is more acceptable.
I'll just repeat the question because we are recording this as well. So the question was, how do you, with some of these ideas, how do you inspire or influence others to adopt these concepts, I guess, to
yes,
summarize the
yes.
question, yeah.
I'd say 2 points come to mind if you're asking from the Rebbe's counseling. One point, very often, especially the parents, the Rebbe writes, again, it's a practical side of the Rebbe's counseling, indirect. Sometimes parents or people in an older position, we have a natural reflex to not listen to. So try in an indirect way. Try influence through someone that you know that they would listen to more, even though it's difficult. But additionally, is the great value of them realizing, which depends on us, that we really only want their benefit and we respect their approach to life and respect their opinion, but for their good, we would love if they understand this. And it's not because we want to extend our opinions further and we wanted to possess more real estate in humans' minds, but we actually think that for the benefit of their life and their world, it would be best if they adopt a certain perspective or a certain behavior. And when people realize, when you're talking it to them for them or to them for yourself, and that makes all the difference. So that's another point to keep in mind. Thank you for the question.
Any other questions? Covered it, you see.
So maybe we're shy in Australia. What is this?
Yes, please, Ben.
I've got a question as a comment. Thank you very much. I was really looking forward to I really wonder what the Rebbe would say today about social media. I really resonate with the idea that we are intrinsically, naturally, I like the word straightforward, but there's an intrinsic goodness, but we are so corrupted, and therefore not we have to fight, mitigate against what young people are exposed to. Mm-hmm. Everything is comparison, social media, and it's not what it's done with the film. And so that probably was before this time.
So, correct. So you're asking what you think, what the Rebbe would say about social media?
Throwing that point.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would say that, interestingly enough, you know, you can't know, right? You can never know for sure. But I think the Rebbe would put a lot of precautions and a lot of cautionary notes. But at the bottom of it, I'll tell you where I draw this from: television. The Rebbe was emphatic that people should not, his Hasidim should not have television in their homes.
Yeah.
And he spoke about, there's a talk in the 1950s that I saw where he said that there was a few young teenagers, Jewish teenagers from ordinary homes who murdered someone. And the Rebbe said he sees a direct link to violence that they've seen on the screen in their home that has normalized violence to them as a practical option. And that caused them to act the way they did. And the Rebbe was very strong about television. That, alongside that, the Rebbe did give sometimes televised remarks, and he did encourage television anchors to use their platform and to utilize it in the best way. And what I think that illustrates is that while we need to have a tremendous amount of caution around technology, at the bottom of it, the Rebbe used to quote a medrash that said, "Lo nivra zav el v'shel beis hamikdash." Gold was only created for the sake of the temple and for holy good purposes. And in order that we should have free choice, Hashem has also left the option of using gold for other purposes. And in the same way with social media, it has and is being used in so many wrong ways. But at the very bottom of it, there is a power there that's potentially positive, that's potentially useful, that potentially could connect us and allow us to engage with higher content and be more communicate with each other and a sense of community. So it's hard to say for sure, but I think maybe if we could draw a comparison to television, there would be a lot of caution and a lot of distancing and boundaries that the Rebbe would put in to recommend, but he wouldn't abolish it. He would say there's a spark. There's a spark there that we should utilize. I have to guess.
No, I think that's...
I agree. Regard, what do you think?
Spot on.
Okay.
Spot on. Okay, one more question, a quick one, because we're running out of time.
Okay. How do you actually differentiate between worry and something that's proper worry and anxiety, something that has no basis, like you said? Like, anxiety feels very real, but worry could feel very...
Okay, so it's a very good question. In the end notes here on that letter, I don't know if you saw the end note of that letter itself that I brought, where the Rebbe makes that distinction. The Rebbe says something very interesting. Doesn't directly answer your question, but it talks to it. Already one. As follows. Although when the thought occupies your mind, there seems to be no difference whether or not it reflects a factual reality. In truth, it is not so. There always exists within a person a reality checker that examines their feelings and the degree of their authenticity and certitude. The results of this assessment affect the person even when their capacity to make a reality check is concealed, or to use the common vernacular, lies within their subconscious. It's a very interesting thing. I have not seen it in another letter since. But what the Rebbe is saying is that we know. Deep down we know. And the fact that deep down we know affects and makes it easier for us to overcome the worries that are not based in reality, because deep down, we're able to check and to sense what is something that is a real concern and what is something that is ultimately not a real concern. So it doesn't directly respond to your question, but I think it's interesting that the Rebbe, like in that very letter, adds this point of the subconscious reality checker, which is behind the scenes helping us when we're discerning and we're dismissing unsubstantiated worries. And the specifics, very hard to give a generalization. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Just want to conclude with just a couple of very short things. Number one, that's fascinating. And as you can tell, I've read the book. And I just want to assure you that what we touched on now is just a little bit. There's so much, much more. And it's a really, really fascinating read. When we finish it, the coffee is going to continue. So those want to have another cup of coffee or didn't have coffee before. We are going to be selling the book. There's a limited amount of editions I actually have here. I'm sure they'll become more available in Sydney as they go along. But if you want one now, signed by Rabbi Levi Shmatkin, they are $28. And you can pay for it by cash or the credit card machine, which will come in a moment. And I just want to also mention, while I've got you all here, Binah is currently running a yearly raffle. If you've bought already, thank you very much. It's a really an important fundraiser for us. If you're able to buy or buy more, whatever the case is, please see Josh in the office. And Rabbi Shmatkin, this was fascinating. We really are pleased that you're here in Sydney. We thank you. Just so you know, Rabbi Levi got off the plane this morning from Perth at 6 a.m. This is the first appearance in Sydney. He's doing speaking in some shuls over Shabbos and some other events. Wish you lots of success. We look forward to the part two of the book.
Wow.
I'm sure there's a lot more to still write about and research. And thank you very much for everyone for coming. Books available now and enjoy another coffee. Wow.